This is Jody Stone interviewing James Edward Vail, that's V-A-I-L-L, on the 19th of November, 1986, at his home in Lakeville. Jim, tell me about your parents. What were their names and where did they come from?
Well, my father and his family were born in Goshen, Connecticut, and Litchfield earlier on. My mother's family was Cornwall, and her name was Marjorie Baldwin Vail. And she lived in the section known as Great Hill, at the foot of Great Hill. And she was born and raised there until she was married.
Your father?
Oh, I did. My father, Benjamin Franklin Vail, is my father.
Yep.
Not to mention his name.
Yes.
Who was also born in Goshen.
When did they come here? And why?
My father, after he was married, managed and started Torrington Creamery in Torrington, Connecticut, and then two or three years later, they moved here after I was a year or two old. I think I was 2 years old. The reason my father came here, he heard that a farm could be leased here, and so he came and leased a farm from William Perry, who owned a Farnham Tavern in Lakeville.
Where was the farm?
The farm's on Wells Hill Road. It started just beyond where Dan Lupton lives now, and extended on both sides. Well, at that time, on the left side of the road, as far as Robin Hill Lane, and up and around and over to Asylum Road, including the lot, the field that Emerson's house is on now. Later on, he purchased Woodland Drive area, which went over to Hotchkiss Road, including the land where Woodland Coffee Shop is, the land that belonged to Mrs. Quayle, and Jack Rogers, Sid Coles, Jack Ollie, and the house next to where Bradley used to live. I don't know who those people are now.
So it went right up to the Hotchkiss School property?
Yes.
Big farm.
He also owned, which was actually the land adjacent and including the Woodland Drive area over to Racetrack Road, where Susan Reich has her horse place now, and the field on the Wells Hill side of that.
What houses were there? I know the Roots house. Was that the main house?
The Roots house was the original farmhouse to our farm, and the original barn was right across the road from Roots house. The foundation is still in existence there. And just below that, at the junction of Woodland Drive, used to be a very nice stoned-up spring that they used to derive the water from for that farm, the house and barn. And sometime after that, the present farmhouse, which I don't know who owns it now, it's next to Lupkin's, the big white house.
Across from the Lupkin's?
No, it's the same side of the road as Lupkin's, and adjacent to Lupkin's property. Mm-hmm. And the barn, present barn, is still in existence by Foxfire Farm, I guess they call it the horse farm now. And the farm buildings included the main cow barn, a cat barn, horse barn, tool shed with grain storage overhead, pig pen, and large slaughterhouse with a handmade wooden windlass arrangement to hoist up the slaughtered animals to be skinned and dressed. And the pig pen was in the back of that with a brook running through it, so the pigs had plenty of water and mud. There was a smokehouse and a big chicken house, hen house, chicken coop. Two large tool sheds, like 7 inch and whatever. I guess that's all the buildings. Oh, an outhouse.
Jim, you said you moved here when you were very young, very young.
When we first moved to Lakeville, we lived in the house that was just sold by Harry and Helen Stanton. I remember living there when I was, I think, around 2 or 3.
What year was that?
Well, it had to be 1923 or 24. And I remember my mother being in the yard with there was the Whalen boys. It was Rick Whalen, Tom Whalen, and Buck Whalen, who was Joe Whalen, and Babe Whalen, who was his name? It was Babe, Buck, and Rick. And I remember my mother out there talking with them in the front yard next to Farnham Road. And there was a big pile of leaves that was raked up. And during that period of time, Farnham Tavern, was, of course, was in existence, being run by William Perry. And I used to be able, at the age of 2.5 or 3, to walk to Farnham Tavern and get oatmeal cookies from the big Negro cook that was there. And oatmeal. I used to call oatmeal once in a while.
Did you go by yourself?
Yeah. There was no traffic in those days. Once in a while, a car.
Dirt roads?
Oh, yes. Well, the main road was paved. But Farnham Road was, in fact, it was called Muck Alley. And I think the term Muck Alley, not only the fact it was money in spring, but the early workers in the handle, the knife factory here, were English, and they dug peat out of the swamp down there, and they called it mucking out peat. And I think that's association with the name for the term Muck Alley. And that hole that was excavation filled in, of course, with water, and we used to skate there as kids.
Where was it?
It was right across from the road to the power transformer mm-hmm. station mm-hmm. on the left, mm-hmm. right across the road from that. I think it's all grown up now, mm-hmm. building. But it used to be a pond. And I remember Walt Finn catching muskrats in that farm.
Where'd you go to school?
Well, first 3 grades, I went to school in what was St. Mary's Hall, which is now an apartments, mm-hmm. next to the Masons, Masonic Hall. And one of my duties, remember, those first 3 grades was going to Pavos, that had a rooming house for right across from the post office. I used to own it. 1821? I mean,
April 56.
April 56.
56, yeah.
Bunny Mogul.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Pavola had a rooming house there. And in fact, Skip Smith now. I remember her telling me that she moved there when she was a girl.
This is Ed's mother?
No, this is Jim Smith's widow.
Mm.
He's since died. He was the chauffeur for John McChesney for years and years and years. And John McChesney used to store his cars in 2 garages and back of 2 floors of garage. And when he wanted Jim to appear, he called him on the phone, and Jim jumped in the car and went up to Hotchkiss and picked up Mr. McChesney. childhood, let's see now. Then we moved to the farm, and I think I was about 5 years old. And that was when the farm was strictly non-mechanical as we know it today. Everything done with horses. There was no electricity. In the barns, the cow barns, they milked the cows and even threw down hay by lantern light. They used to plow by horses. We did have one tractor that we used primarily for belt power. Run a wood saw and to fill the silo. On the farm, there's two ice houses, too. The big ice house is now a two-car garage that's at an angle to our old farmhouse. And I remember going to Lake the Lake with my father and the horse and the sleigh, and Pete Lorenzo's father used to cut ice off of Lake the Lake for so much a cake for any farmers or anybody that stored ice, who was, all the hotels did too at those times. In fact, Bill Perry would never drink a scotch and water without natural ice. This ice cutting machine was quite an ingenious invention. A Ford motor hooked up on sled runners with a big circular saw like he used to cut cordwood with. And he would lower the saw that was burning at great speed. And somehow, I forgot whether he had a horse or something, pulling that sled, maybe it was manpower, because it had to be inched forward just slightly. And he would saw down through, say, if the ice was a foot thick, he would saw down to about 8 inches of the ice in a gridlock formation, about 2 feet by 4 feet. And then he'd go along with a pointed pike, I think they called them, and jabbed it down in the saw cut, and it'd break out enormous slabs of ice, and then they'd be broken up in 4 foot lengths. They were then hauled up a chute onto a platform and slid onto the horse-drawn sleighs and transported to wherever they're going. And then, once the sleigh load of ice got to the farm, there was a chute that went down from the ice house, and as the layers of ice were built up, they were packed in sawdust, a big layer on the bottom, and then a layer of ice would be put on with the sawdust spread over the top of that layer of ice and through the cracks in between the ice and around the edges, at least 6 or 8 inches thick. And the ice house itself was insulated with sawdust. And this, as the layers built up, the chute was raised up to the next layer, and the ice was hauled up the chute by ice tongue arrangement with a pulley and a rope, and a horse pulling the rope. And of course, they'd hook the tongs onto the cake of ice, and then the horse would go up, go along the road and pull the ice up the chute. And then two men would be up in the ice house and slide it around to where they wanted it. And that was quite a long period of time that took.
How much ice would a farm that size store?
In tonnage, I have no idea, but it could be figured out. The ice house was probably 30 feet wide and at least 40 feet deep, and maybe 20 feet wide. And there's 7 gallons to a cubic foot, if you want to figure it out.
Who were the people who worked on the farm?
There were a number of permanent families that worked for my father. One was the Farland family, and Sarah Jones, Harold Jones's mother, was one of the Merrill daughters, and that's another family. There's the Merrills, We always had a live-in hired man in addition to their Carl, Marils. They were the main families. My father owned the house. It was now the, let's see, on the Catholic Church parking lot. It's the first, second, third house on the left. That was one of the tenant houses. It's across where they're rebuilding that house now.
Jack Rogers is rebuilding.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Lou Gold used to have it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, the Golds. Mm. Yes.
And the other house is where Roots live now. And that was where the Merrills lived.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in part of the house and in where Roots' side door by their driveway is, was the entrance to another so-called apartment. But there used to be a cigar maker. And he used to sit there and make handmade cigars. He later moved to Lakeville and a shoemaker. Lived in that section of the house, plus the Merrill family.
And where was your house?
The old farmhouse.
Okay.
Next to Buckton's place.
Yeah. Who lived in the Jabald house? That must have been, that was part of the farm.
No, that wasn't part of our farm. No, that was a separate, it was owned by Ernest Elmo Coppins. And he was quite a nice old gentleman. Very dignified, had a chauffeur, housekeeper, and a maid. And he lived there until Jabald's mother. In fact, Dr. Jabald went in to see Mr. Coppins and said, when and if you decide to sell me, I'll buy your house. And he's a children, so that's how the Jabald farm.
So that was not in your kind of farm?
No. That was a little section of the
I was going to say, it's a cutout section of your farm.
See, where Charlie Hines used to live, mm-hmm. in a man shop across from where Flynn's used to live. Mm-hmm. Jack Flynn was a part of that farm. And there's that house with Charlie Hines at that.
Before he bought Grasslands.
Yeah. And then Mr. Balls.
Okay.
And up Asylum Road on that road was Dr. Casper and his family. Two beautiful twin blonde daughters that I fell desperately in love with all my teenage days. And one of them married John Bianchi.
Oh.
Who died.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, Jack Brooks. Well, that's the house of Jack Brooks.
Yes, yes.
And then was the big farmhouse that Jemison bought and since demolished. And that was original Wells' house, a stone. And across from that house, where Peter inspector. Yeah, who was our building inspector?
Okay.
Peter Oliver. Excuse me, Peter. That used to be a horse barn for the original Wells stables, and down below was a cow barn. And at one side upstairs was a fancy panel tack room with all the blue ribbons from his horses and the saddles and all that, and the harnesses. It was on Racetrack Road, of course, for the racetrack that Dr. Mel Bloom, Bill Ford, and Paul Cleveland resurrected. Well, before I forget, when I was very young, the grandstand for that great racetrack was still standing. And I vaguely remember it was fairly small. It probably wasn't over 12 feet deep, and may have held 30 people at the most. That either burned down, something happened there, I think it burned down. But to get back to buildings on that Salem Road, at that time, that was all the buildings that were there. Peter Oliver's mother-in-law's house was originally the farmer for Thorns used to live there. His name was Harry Frank. How do you like that in the email to pass?
Indeed.
And then Mrs. Ladd bought it and put it in the model. Tore down the foreign barn and built the existing house on there now.
This, the farm, your farm, mm-hmm. family farm, that was commercial?
Yes, primarily a dairy farm. At first, we just sold milk to Mitchell Dairy in Bridgeport. And all the farmers used to bring the milk, cans of milk, down to Community Services Yard, about where their yard office is now. There's a big wooden platform where all the milk cans were piled upon, sat upon. And once a day, early in the morning, we'd have to milk, and all the farmers would milk there. And the day before, because it would be cool. In those days, no refrigeration, so there were 40-quart cans of milk were put into a, after the milk was strained, was put into a vat with cakes of ice to cool the milk, and periodically stirred to circulate to them. And that, the days before milk would be put on a wagon and brought to Community Service and brought to Bridgeport by truck.
By truck, not train?
No, so it was truck. The trains were running, passenger trains and freight trains. In fact, I remember going to Hartford and getting on the train at Whitefield Station and going to visit my grandmother in Hartford. I was about 6 or 7.
Long trip? Lots of stops?
I don't remember entirely how long it took, but we went through first Canaan, Norfolk, Winston, New Hartford, to Satan's Kingdom.
Right along 44.
Yeah, and then I went up to Simsbury, if I can round the mountain. Mm-hmm. I think. Maybe went to Farmington. I forgot at that age I didn't.
No.
You said commercial farm.
Yeah.
He also grew potatoes, even in those days, about where Robin Hill, Robin Hill Lane is now. And his primary market was Hotchkiss School. And the potatoes were stored in the cellar of our old farmhouse. There was a dirt cellar with wooden bins in there. We piled in there in the fall. And periodically during the winter, as Hotchkiss meeting, we'd bag them and haul them up there in the horse and wagon. It seemed like they had to be carried about a half a mile to corridors to be dumped into a bin, I think. And of course, later on, he went into a commercial. State of mind. That's when you
But that road was always there, racetrack road.
Mm. Yeah, that was one time quite a main road. It started in Salisbury and then along the base of the mountain down by Indian Cave and where Ingersolls used to live by Miner's Farm. And then it went up in two Dark Hollow, to Mr. Cannon's dooryard, that was a town farm, right next to his front door, and across the road, and up the side of the road, across where the watering kettle is by Duval's racetrack road, and two miners' farm, George Miles, over the hill and to Seymour's property. I don't know the names of them.
Blum.
And at one point, that branched off and came out on Stone House Road in Sharon.
Oh, sure. Way down that far.
Yeah, it branched off that one road and went down.
Closure Road.
Is that what
that dead end road there. When was this area, this Woodland Drive, Rock Ledge, when was that developed? Did your father do it?
He bought the property, I think, in about 1934. And this was virgin pine timber in those days. And we cut by hand, cross-cut saws, we cut over 1 million board feet of lumber out of these boards and put them down. And that's a lot of cross-cut saws.
You said it. To sell, not to build one.
Well, actually, my uncle was on Watertown Building Supply Company, and he did a lot of building. And he used mostly lumber. This is just before World War II and during World War II.
What was his name, your uncle?
Bob, Robert Bear. And lumber was hard to get then, so he used a lot of this native lumber to do his building. And developing, it tied Woodman Drive Road, probably was put in about 1947, 48.
Just part way. It didn't make a complete circle. Did it?
Wait, I take that back. It was later than that. I think it was in the 50s.
Well, our house was built in 50.
Well, that, it was just before that.
Okay.
So it must have been late 40s or early.
But it didn't come all the way around then, did it?
Yes.
Did it make a circle?
Mm-hmm. Later on, that where Adams lives now, we put that in later. The original Woodman Drive is as it is now.
Was there not at one point a plan to connect it through to Route 41?
Never.
Never?
No, I made a sort of a trail down there.
Yes, I know.
Property.
People still touch his kids use it all the time.
No, we always had a right of way by the Woodman Coffee Shop. My father built that, too.
Did he?
Yeah.
Did he build all these houses in this circle?
No. He just built where Chris Bacon was built, here in the corner across from by the Paul O'Brien. And across the road down and back.
Let's see, it goes Soper, Moore.
Right past Soper.
Moore got tucked way in, yes.
Dickens House.
Yeah, where the Ely's lived at one point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Never lived there. Can we turn that off?
Sure. Now, your sister is Janet
Moss. And she and Paul got married in Florida and came up here, I think, about 1955 or so. And Janet and Paul built the house that Bob Fales is living in now, and the house that you're living in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then they built the present house.
Yeah. Now, you were saying the other day when we were sitting here talking about a cabin that you had in the woods that you built when you were a young boy. Where was that?
That was what I was about 14, it should have been 1935 or so. George Cleveland, of course, the Clevelands and Vales had the farms up here. Oh, up where, before I forget it, farm where Fran Gomez.
Quality farm?
Yeah. That was owned by Alvaro Sabin. A real old-time farm. And then Dewey Dilbert bought it from him or his estate and created what is there now before that time.
Yes.
My uncle built that barn, by the way, out of lumber that came out of this.
Out of these woods?
In fact, all those buildings are.
Really?
This
really?
And in fact, Bellini's house up here was built out of this lumber. And Remington's house next to Bellini's.
So you and Paul built this cabin?
No, George.
George, okay.
And George and I built the cabin. One of the sawmill sites is about where the trailer is over there. The built it out of course. Native lumber out the sawmill, and the siding was slabs, so the edge was squared off. And the building was about 16 by 20, I would think. with a big front porch, a kitchen, a bedroom, and two built-in beds in the living room, with a big ornate wood stove, and a beautiful Victrola, hand-wind-up Victrola cabinet record player.
What'd you use it for, Tim?
Mainly for parties,
mm-hmm.
entertain,
mm-hmm.
and during hunting season, George and Edward Kipp, Merrill Penn, and I primarily would stay down there hunting season and camp out and go hunting, drinking, etc. Walt Penn and Jack Fisher in the school my group too.
What happened to it?
It finally got vandalized tremendously by hospice boys and to avoid any complications. My father finally demolished it, tore down my cabin, and part of the paneling is still in our old office to San Miguel on my Lamont Station. I'm going to resurrect the paneling out of there.
Is that when you started to realize you were so good with building?
Oh, no.
We always
built things on the farm. You had, you know, had to learn how to do everything.
But this house, I mean, look at it.
That is true. Maybe a culmination of living as long as I have and doing what I've done all my life.
Mm.
I did all the planning and the plumbing, heating, finished work, all the cabinets, everything I did. Then I didn't do the wiring.
You did the chestnut staircase, right?
Isn't that Bill Washburn built the staircase. I didn't do that.
But you salvaged the wood.
Oh, yes. The chestnut came out of an old vegetable bin in the basement of the old Perkins house. I turned into apartments.
Where's that?
Next to the Iron Master's Motel. And my wife has the antique shop, Bad Corner Antiques.
I didn't know those were apartments. I thought the motel used those for extra accommodations.
Never?
Mm-mm.
And where John Mondial lives now down there, we're diversing a little bit from the subject. That used to be one of the miners' cottages for the Davis ore down there. And I moved that up here and rebuilt it to what Mondial's have now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And where the Chez Villette restaurant is another miners' cottage.
Oh.
In fact, they called it Miner's Cottage,
yes,
didn't they?
Yes, exactly.
When they built the motel, I bulldozed down, I think, two other houses. They didn't go.
Yeah, of course. If you go past the Miner's Cottage, Shavia,
mm-hmm.
no, I'm wrong. I'm thinking of that road that goes to the, if you're coming through Lakeville towards Salisbury and you pass, is it Bob Noble's old house? And you, there's a road that, no, that's a road. What I'm thinking of, is there an ore bed behind the motel and
certainly.
A house back in there that you
yeah,
can never see?
Rosenthal,
that's
certainly.
What I'm thinking of. Is the ore bed back there?
Yes. I still own 5 acres up back there.
Around the bed?
Not around it, but mm-hmm. adjacent to it. Right in the back of the motel.
Okay.
That whole hill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, there used to be a railroad going up to there, to the ore bed. I went down and, you know, tied in with a railroad against a lake bed. And the ore was taken to Canaan, I believe, to be smelted.
Tell me about the track. When I moved here in 49, the racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
That was an ore bed, or
no.
What was it, a gravel? It was something.
Well, originally my father bought that to grow potatoes and later sweet corn. And we used to grow in excess of 100 cows a bushel. And at one time, I'm sure it was 150. Because we also used to grow potatoes up in Sheffield and back of what used to be the Blue Belt and Inn. Hauling down with trailer trucks. And there was a potato storage building on the infield, about where the uphill turn is now, a large underground potato storage building that we built to store potatoes in the winter. But that was strictly a big commercial operation. Also, when we grew sweet corn, we used to pick 20,000 ears of sweet corn a day.
Not by hand.
Well, there again, George Cleveland was one of the most brilliant guys I've ever known in my life. And George and I designed, and he did most of the designing, I think, of a sweet corn picking machine that would pick six rows. I mean, bigger snapped off the hand, but this was a tripod, looked like a big grasshopper going down through the field of corn. It was 6 feet above the ground, and driven by two big wheels spaced apart 12 feet. And then a front wheel, like a farm tractor, double front wheel. It was a tricycle type arrangement. And there was four elevators to fit down in between the rows. It went up to a platform, and the hopper on the bottom of each elevator, and we used to get high school kids to snap off the ears of corn, drop them in this bin at the bottom of the elevator, and we carried up the elevator to the table where four ladies would sit and put them, shove them into a hole and bag, 100 ears to a bag, and somebody would be there, pile the bags on the back end of this contraption, and it looked like that, to the end of the row, and they would put in a shade, and then pick six more rows. And we used to pick, as I said, 20,000 ears a day, and at midnight, we'd have to go down and load a trailer truck load full of sweet corn, after picking the things all day, and it's on day after day for about a month or 6 weeks. Well, let me start at the beginning with the racetrack. Jack Fisher, in his younger, more frisky days, as we all were in those days, bought an MDTC, just like Bud Gale has. And every Sunday, we used to go down to what the infield is now. We used to go sweet corn there at the time. And I had photos around the perimeter of the was the infield now, perimeter of the whole infield, and we used to take turns, only that poor injury around the that cornfield, raising huge clouds of dust, and we just beat that poor injury to bits every Sunday. I wonder if it still ran. And one Sunday, as we were there having our onion sandwiches and drinking a can of beer, a cool ride, but two carloads of people from the Sports Car Club of America who had heard that I was building a sports car track. It never entered my mind before then. Well, it sort of started a germ of thought going, and I decided that might be a good idea. So I looked into it and decided, first of all, to see how the town felt about it, so I called a town meeting. I borrowed a sound movie from the Sports Car Club of America with projectors that I and speakers that I borrowed from Dutch's Auto. I had Bill Conklin running the machine, and I showed a two-hour film of the race of Le Mans, France. And the town says they did not know what was going on. They heard every act, saw every action, every sound, every screech, every roar of that undiluted, noisy film. And I started from there, and I really did an awful lot trying to raise money, selling money in a non-existent corporation on an idea. I managed to raise $100,000, and I built that whole racetrack for $100,000, less than that, actually. And we just started building the track in the spring of 1955. We had all the lower part cleared, where the straightaway is now, was an impenetrable jungle. In fact, when I started clearing the land, I went down to the end of the land by next to Bird Dolls and started with a D8 bulldozer. And I couldn't tell where I was. I had to follow the brook, winding brook, back up through to find my way back to the existing sand and gravel building at that point. And that's how thick it was, with enormous elms, maples, that you just couldn't get through. And we had just started clearing that land when the August flood of 1955 came along. Both, we had a D7 bulldozer, a D4 bulldozer, a D8 bulldozer, 6 dump trucks, the whole screening plant, crushing plant, the shop, and was all wiped out by that flood. There was headlines in the journal showing the valley of the Lime Rock, it looked just like the Mississippi River. And this is the end of the dream.
Mm. Was that from the Millbrook?
That was a whole watershed from Mount Regan all the way down through.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't start working on the track for, I think, the next 6 months, until the next spring. We managed to exist, because we weren't insured against any floods. I think bank and did everything. But by sheer perseverance and a lot of help from a lot of people, I managed to get it built. I designed it by an aerial photograph of the whole property, a Fairchild aerial photograph. I got a call from Cornell University wanting to know who designed the track and how they derived at the radii of the corners. As if by sitting on a bulldozer and seeing which way I wanted to do it.